Local news, culture, and NPR.
From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me. Coming up, a new documentary, Who Killed Shireen, was recently screened by advocates and activists in Kingston to foster important discussions about Israel and Palestine and the dangers that journalists face. Radio Catskill's Genevieve Hartnett was on the scene and brings us her report. That's coming up in the second half of the program. And fracking is back in the news. Our colleagues with Marketplace reported yesterday that demand for natural gas is rising, even as demands for oil are dropping. And in our region, pro-fracking interests are pushing officials to overturn the Delaware River Basin Commission's fracking ban. So local environmental groups are pledging to keep the watershed free from fracking. Julia Kim talks to the Delaware Riverkeeper Network and Catskill Mountain Keeper, and that story's coming right up. But we start with some news from nearby Orange County. That's where Congressman Pat Ryan of New York's 18th District was yesterday, and he was there to highlight how the Trump administration's policies are impacting farms in the region. WAMC's Hudson Valley Bureau Chief Jesse King reports.
So these are the
pink lighting. Yeah.
All right, perfect.
Ryan, a Democrat from the 18th District, stopped by Crist Brothers Orchards in Walden to try out some apples and ask farmers how they're doing. Fifth-generation farmer Jeff Crist has expanded Crist Brothers Orchards significantly over his tenure. The orchard now produces roughly 500,000 bushels of apples each year. But he's got his eye on how the president's tariffs may impact his ability to buy equipment and export apples overseas.
We estimate between August 1st, which was last week, through the end of the year, tariffs we pay on different pieces of equipment will cost us about $60,000 on our farm.
It's not just tariffs. Ryan says he's heard from Hudson Valley farmers who worry they will lose their Medicaid coverage as a result of new work requirements in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. Others say their staffing is at risk from federal efforts to ramp up deportations. And Ryan says agricultural scientists and food banks are reeling from funding cuts at the USDA.
The cuts to federal funding for research and development in ag and farming, to me, are extremely concerning. Because this makes us just less competitive, both immediately and in the medium and long term, as a country and specifically as a region in the Hudson Valley.
Crist says agricultural research by schools like Cornell University has been instrumental in his farm's success. For starters, Crist Brothers Orchards bought the intellectual property rights to two apple breeds created by Cornell University's breeding program, the Snapdragon and Ruby Frost. He says Cornell scientists visit the farm multiple times a year and taught them how to mitigate pests and prune trees in a way that helps each apple receive better sunlight. Just in the past couple of years, Crist says the farm has refined how it stores its crops and now has the technology to store apples in a way that keeps them fresh for up to 12 months, meaning grocers who want Fuji apples year-round can, in fact, buy them from Crist Brothers Orchards.
The growing and the technology and science we use literally changes every year to improve what we do to be able to store apples for 12 months. We were never able to do that before. So it's over a period of time, it's a huge impact to keep us competitive in the world.
Crist says his orchard ships thousands of pounds of apples to the Regional Food Bank of Northeastern New York each month. But that number may differ amid cuts to the USDA's Emergency Food Assistance Program, or TFAP. Earlier this year, the USDA announced it was cutting roughly $1 billion from two programs, including TFAP, that source local produce for food banks. Ryan says he's hopeful that some of that funding may be restored, even if not fully. The same can't be said for SNAP, which took a big hit in the Big Beautiful Bill. Lucy Joyce, executive director of the Cornell Cooperative Extension in Orange County, says the law also gutted funding for SNAP's educational grant program, SNAP Ed. SNAP Ed funds programs in schools and community organizations that teach low-income residents how to make the most of their food budgets, including making healthier food choices and becoming more physically active. Joyce says CCE Orange County is one of the lead agencies implementing these programs, holding more than 900 classes across the Hudson Valley last year. But as a result of the cuts, it will effectively end on September 30th. Joyce says 11 staff members will lose their jobs.
At this time, it looks like New York State has some funding in their coffers through this programming. With that funding, we're looking for guidance to be able to wind it down in a more professional manner where it won't be such an abrupt end.
During his visit, Ryan touted his support for bills like the Dignity Act, which he says would create a better pathway for citizenship for immigrants who make up a large share of the nation's agricultural workforce. He points to the partial return of TFAP funding as an example of what residents can accomplish when they speak out.
To be specific and local, sharing these stories is actually really powerful.
In Poughkeepsie, I'm Jesse King for the New York Public News Network.
Thank you, Jesse King. In our next story, folks are talking about fracking again. A couple of weeks ago, the Delaware River Keeper Network released its pledge of resistance and protection against increasing efforts by pro-fracking interests to get local and federal officials to overturn the fracking ban in the watershed enacted by the Delaware River Basin Commission, or DRBC. Radio Catskill's Julia Kim spoke with Delaware River Keeper Network Deputy Director Tracy Carluccio and Catskill Mountain Keeper Environmental Justice Coordinator Taylor Jaffe about their response to this political shift in favor of fracking.
For the 8 million people who live within the Delaware River watershed and the additional 9 million people who rely on the river for their fresh water, the watershed serves as a critical lifeline. The area, which includes portions of New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Delaware, contains 9 national parks and 400 miles of river that are designated as national wild and scenic rivers, with the free-flowing Delaware being home to unique ecotypes such as the endangered Atlantic sturgeon and the American eel and American shad. But now, that's under attack. Alongside other organizations, the environmental nonprofit Delaware Riverkeeper Network established a pledge of resistance and protection against increasing efforts spurred by the Trump administration to overturn the watershed's ban on fracking in a press statement released on July 16th. These pro-fracking efforts have also been coupled with two other issues that the statement outlined, including legislative attempts to wrest control away from the Delaware River Basin Commission, the governing body of the watershed, as well as attacks against the DRBC's DEI and climate change programs. What first raised the alarm, Delaware Riverkeeper Network Deputy Director Tracy Carluccio said, was a closed-door meeting back in March between Congressman Rob Bresnahan, who represents parts of Wayne County, Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Lee Zeldin, and local pro-fracking interests on challenging the DRBC's fracking ban.
They did not invite the public and they did not invite the Delaware River Basin Commission. They talked about how they wanted to undo the fracking ban, that they wanted to open up or unleash the energy resources that were contained in the shale by fracking in Pennsylvania.
This meeting was one piece of a larger plan to transform the state into a center for AI development. According to the River Reporter, the recent Pennsylvania Energy and Innovation Summit hosted by Senator Dave McCormick announced $90 billion in investments towards developing natural gas and data center infrastructure, with $25 billion specifically earmarked for natural gas power generation in Wayne and Pike counties. Trump was in attendance at the summit, aligning with his administration's broader push to dismantle environmental protections and privatize natural resources for energy development. And alongside these investments, Senator McCormick has also been working on creating a $7 billion liquefied natural gas export terminal on the Delaware River, directly meeting with Penn-America Energy Holdings in March to discuss its construction. Pennsylvania is currently the second largest producer of natural gas in the country, and about one-third of the Delaware River watershed is built upon the Marcellus and Utica shales, which are the main sources for fracking in the state. But the process of fracking poses significant risk to the natural environment, which had driven the DRBC to institute their 2021 ban on fracking in the first place, Carluccio said. In addition to fracking releasing methane, a greenhouse gas 86 times more powerful than carbon dioxide in warming the planet, and which constitutes about 97% of natural gas, the actual liquid that is injected into the shale has proven to be extremely toxic.
In terms of the chemical end of it, a lot of these chemicals that they add to the mixture that's injected with water underground then causes that wastewater that comes back up with the gas to be highly polluted. And because it's so polluted, it has to, under the Clean Water Act, not just be dumped on the ground right there. They have to capture it. They have to treat it before it goes, you know, back into the environment. Unfortunately, most of the pollutants are not removed when they do that. And one of the most dangerous pollutants that are in this wastewater that comes back up are naturally occurring pollutants. Those are pollutants that are trapped in the rock deep underground, such as radioactivity and heavy metals. So they don't remove the radioactivity. They can't remove all the metals. And then they have these added chemicals that they've used in the fracking process. So this highly toxic wastewater comes back up. It can't be fully cleaned. And so you're degrading that water quality. And what they end up doing is basically giving permits to pollute to companies to treat it to a certain amount and then release it. There's been different studies done by academia and others that when they do studies of the sediments downstream from some of these wastewater facilities that are supposedly treating the wastewater and making it safe, they find high levels of radioactivity in the sediments. And that's because they're not removing the radioactivity. And this is really, you know, a degradation, a spiral downward of our entire environment, because that radioactivity gets into the fish, it gets into the food chain, and it gets into the water itself and affects those who drink from the river downstream, as well as those, you know, who eat the fish or, you know, are exposed to it through the air.
Carluccio explained that the extensive amount of water used towards making the fracking liquid has its own host of negative effects on the flow of waterways as well. Signature species like the American eel require a free-flowing river to make the migration from their birthplace, the Sargasso Sea, to their final destination in the upper Delaware.
The typical way that they get the water is they get an allocation permit from, in the most of Pennsylvania, it's the Susquehanna River Basin Commission, which is the watershed to the west of us. And they'll basically put their, you know, pipeline in and they'll withdraw the water. So what happens is they are taking water out of the hydrologic system, because when they take that water and then they frack it, number one, it never comes back in the same quality that it came back in, as we discussed, because it's mixed with wastewater and it has all those chemicals in it. But also a lot of the water is trapped underground. It doesn't come back up. So what's happening is you're actually losing the amount of water, the volume of water, and it's only about 10% that comes back up. So all that other water is lost and it's trapped underground, and we've lost access to that. So over time, we're reducing the ability of the natural hydrologic system to replenish our waterways and replace what fracking is using. That's one thing that we fought to have included in the ban in the Delaware River watershed, but we have not yet been successful to do that. Right now, there is no water being taken from the Delaware River for fracking, but it is legal for them to do that.
Water quality is essential for a watershed that supplies millions of people with drinking water. Catskill Mountain Keeper Environmental Justice Coordinator Taylor Jaffe said the Pepin, Neversink, and Cannonsville reservoirs in the area serve as particularly critical sources for residents of the Catskills, describing being able to drink fresh water right from a spring on our property. But beyond providing fresh water, its recreational opportunities have served to bring billions of dollars in ecotourism for local economies and have come to cultivate the very communities that line the river.
One thing that I want to point out that is so has really shaped the culture of these communities is the trout. And fly fishing was invented in the Catskill region, and it's so important to the character of the communities here. And so if we're, you know, talking about something that stands to threaten our waterways, of course that would pollute them, hurt our fish. And that is just one example of, like, here's this thing that is so sacred to all the communities out here, whether it's leisure, whether it's, you know, how you're obtaining a source of, you know, nutrition, whether it's just your culture, you know, it might just be that your great-great-grandfather started fly fishing and this has been something that's passed down.
And for residents in the four states that comprise the watershed, the risks of fracking directly extend to them. Science has linked fracking to respiratory problems, neurological issues, and even childhood cancers as found in southwestern Pennsylvania, according to Carluccio. And the health risks of pollution have been disproportionately concentrated in low-income communities and communities of color, whom oil and gas companies have historically made into sacrifice zones for energy development, Jaffe explained.
And I really want to make sure that folks understand that when we're talking about environmental justice, we're looking at the intersection of how race and income impact either the environmental benefits or burdens that a community is living with. And so in the case of fracking, there's kind of two factors at work that I want to point out today. First, fracking developers often prey on low-income communities and communities of color to site these frack pads and wells. You know, people early on when we really didn't know the consequences of fracking, it was an offer of a lot of money to have these developers put the frack pad on your property. And so, of course, it happened that low-income communities and communities of color were preyed on, and that resulted in those communities becoming the front lines of contamination and poisoning. The second piece that I want to point out is that areas where, you know, fracking has happened and the consequences are there, all of that contamination, all of that poison is there, they become less valuable places to live in terms of like property value. So if you have the means to move out, you're likely to move out because your health is at risk. And that means that people who don't have the means to move out can't. And it also means that sometimes folks who can't afford now to live in this community where prices have just went up, they might get pushed into these contaminated places.
Carluccio said the watershed and its residents are already feeling the impacts of climate change.
Climate change is here. It's a disaster. We are experiencing the climate crisis day in and day out. The Upper Delaware has experienced it through flooding. We have experienced it through storm surges. We have experienced it through sea level rise in the lower part of the Delaware. We're very concerned about the intrusion of salt as it moves up river and the effect of that on water intakes for over 2 million people in New Jersey and Pennsylvania who get their water directly from the Delaware River intakes. And in the Upper Delaware last year, many farmers came out to the DRBC meeting and talked about how it's affecting agricultural practices and making things more difficult. We had experienced a drought last year.
The resolution comes amid other federal efforts to shift control from the DRBC to the federal government. An intimidation tactic, Carluccio said Representatives Bresnahan and Scott Perry introduced a bill that would review the DRBC alongside two other compact commissions.
Congressman Bresnahan did have a town hall after that, and he spoke up at the town hall about trying to rein in bureaucrats like the Delaware River Basin Commission. So as far as this bill is concerned, it has been introduced. It hasn't moved yet, but it looks at two other commissions as well, and these are compact commissions that were formed over the years, and we feel that it is an intimidation technique that they are trying to basically figure out how they can try to wrest control away from the DRBC. Now, this is not an easy thing for them to do. The Delaware River Basin Commission was formed by an act of Congress. It has been in place since 1961. It is backed up by statutes that have been passed by all of the four states that make up the Delaware River Basin Commission. The federal representative only has one vote, and the four governors have the majority if they agree on a decision. And there is absolutely no movement that we have seen, and statements from the Delaware River Basin Commission confirm that there is absolutely no movement to try to undo the fracking ban or to give up any of the authority or jurisdiction that the DRBC has over the watershed. And that's very important that we make sure that there is not an effort made behind closed doors or in public by the federal government to try to wrest control away, because watershed planning is what has improved the Delaware River, and it has allowed for all communities to participate equally. And we cannot allow that to slip away, and we won't let that slip away.
I just spoke with Tracy Carluccio of Delaware Riverkeeper Network and Taylor Jaffe of Catskill Mountain Keeper on increasing efforts to reintroduce fracking into the Delaware River watershed. In Liberty, I'm Julie Kim for Radio Catskill.
Thank you, Julia.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
It is The Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. A new documentary produced by Zateo Media, Who Killed Shireen, is about Shireen Abu Akleh, a Palestinian-American journalist who was born in East Jerusalem, raised in New Jersey, and provided award-winning coverage of the West Bank for Al Jazeera until she was shot and killed there in 2022. A coalition in the Hudson Valley working to raise awareness about Shireen's case in particular and the ongoing conflict in general screened the documentary Sunday at the Old Dutch Church in Kingston, New York. Radio Catskill's Genevieve Hartnett was there and met with the organizers of the event ahead of time to discuss Shireen Abu Akleh's legacy and creating spaces for open conversations about difficult subjects.
It's a sunny late summer Sunday at the Old Dutch Church in Kingston. And at the front of a church courtyard fence, there is a photo of a woman in a blue press vest that reads, quote, Shireen Abu Akleh, Palestinian-American journalist, 1971 to 2022, murdered by an Israeli sniper. Shireen, we will never forget. As you enter the doors of the church, there are people of all ages who are here. Some are wearing keffiyehs, others in shirts with watermelon designs, a symbol of solidarity with Palestine. Local artist Mimi Fortunato has even taken the time to make a cape that bears the name of the documentary that is being screened here today. Who Killed Shireen? Shireen Abu Akleh was a prominent Palestinian-American journalist who worked at Al Jazeera. And as identified in the documentary, she was killed by IDF Captain Alon Sakaju.
Just the premise of the documentary itself, it's about investigating the murder of a journalist in the West Bank, in Jenin, in 2022. This particular journalist, what makes the story especially is that it's a Palestinian-American journalist who was killed in the line of duty with clearly marked vest that has press, big press written on it, with a crew and camera crew and everyone there, clearly identified as press.
That's Khalid, one of the organizers of the event, who paid for the licensing of the documentary produced by Zateo Media, the independent media company founded by former MSNBC host Mehdi Hassan. We met before the event to discuss why this story, which took the life of an American journalist a year before the attacks on October 7th, 2023, was an important one to bring to New York State.
So this was in 2022 when that happened. Just in Gaza since 2023, more journalists have been killed than in World War I, World War II, invasion of Afghanistan, invasion of Vietnam combined. That's the highest rate of journalists killed. And you would not know that because there's just not even the slightest hint of outrage in any of the mainstream media about that reality.
Before guests sit down for the documentary, they are greeted with a table adorned with fragrant red roses, chilled mint tea, cookies wrapped in parchment paper and sealed with a heart sticker of the Palestinian flag, and slices of juicy watermelon. This event is being hosted by a group of organizations, including Rally Middletown, Jewish Voices for Peace Hudson Valley, Middle East Crisis Response, Mid-Hudson Valley Democratic Socialists of America, and Muslims for Muslims International. Event organizers opened the screening to the community and hosted breakout discussions after, where people could ask questions about Israel and Palestine, hopefully reducing polarization and bringing more folks into the conversation.
Our mission is to provide participants with an opportunity to connect with the humanity of individual Palestinians.
Mimi Fortunato.
Specifically to center Palestinian voice and to expose the truth.
Israel's then Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, blamed Palestinians for her killing and set up a narrative that Israeli soldiers would never intentionally target a journalist clearly wearing body armor labeled with press.
And the story is investigating who pulled the trigger, but in the course of the documentary, it becomes very clear that it's not just about the specific name of the person, a soldier who killed her, but rather about the system that resulted in that happening, the systematic dehumanization, the lack of accountability, and unfortunately, and this is relevant to us in the United States, the cover-up and the complicity of the U.S. government in not only not even demanding justice, but completely covering for that. And there's, in the documentary, there is mentions of how the previous administration, when this was happening, really went out of their way to cover the story and not bring justice to Shireen Abu Akleh.
While the documentary sees the Zateo journalists travel all the way to Tel Aviv, Israel, and Jenin in the West Bank in order to identify Shireen's killer, there was one person who they didn't speak to, Shada Hanesha, a Palestinian journalist who was with Shireen on the day she was murdered. Luckily for the attendees at Old Dutch Church, the organizers of the event took the time to track her down and interview her before the event in a recording that was shown after the documentary. Since 2023, Israel has targeted and killed over 200 Palestinian journalists.
Because oftentimes you hear about them as actually deliberately in a passive tone. If you read the New York Times, well, you know, people were starved or something happened, someone died. You don't really hear the story. They're just numbers. They're just footnotes in the history.
It's a reality that Shahed knows well. An Arabic teacher and freelance journalist born in Gaza, Shahed survived Israel's bombing of Rafah, Han Yunus, and Jabalia refugee camp and its subsequent murder of 90 people on March 3, 2024. Her family then fled to Egypt, and she applied to Bard College, where she is about to start her second year. She's here today as a discussion leader.
The audience wasn't really huge, it was small, but it was real, and I could see that people were really like concerned with what's happening, and I appreciate that. It always makes me feel so like supported and in solidarity with. So I love such spaces, and yeah, I feel like the world should and have to do more for Palestinians, but it's not enough, sadly. And I understand that like many people are living in fear, especially now. I would just say that we really need more call to action, and we really need more people knowing about what's going on.
Israel does not allow Western media organizations into Gaza, leaving most Western journalists to cover Israel and Palestine from Tel Aviv. Both Khalid and Shahed say this often leads to biased coverage towards Israel.
We need more journalists so that they experience what's happening there and know what we're talking about. But at the same time, it's important to also know that we need to see what Palestinian journalists talk about the same way that Western journalists talk about, and or even not the same way, because like the Palestinian journalists talk out of like personal experiences. So we need to even like trust them more and believe them more.
In partnership with the Old Dutch Church, the coalition plans to hold two more film screenings that center Palestinian voices. And as she starts her next school year, Shahed plans to return and keep building community with others who are working towards liberation, education, and future action.
I cannot hide that I grew up in Gaza. I mean, how can I? It's like it's faking an identity. I cannot hide what I've seen in the Gaza Strip. I cannot hide all of the trauma, all of the times that I was very close to being killed by Israeli soldiers. And it was like it did happen many times. So it's just like I really can't act as if I didn't live 23 years of my life in the Gaza Strip. I view a future of which I will be trying my best to raise awareness, to do advocacy, and to do the things that I've been learning. I mean, like, as a Palestinian, I've seen a lot of violations of human rights, but I'll just try as much as I can, because it's the only way that I can live, to maintain as much hope as I can, because I believe in the power of people, and like my power is connecting with others, is working with others, even though it feels like a small, but I'm sure in the long run it will cause something.
In Kingston, I'm Genevieve Hartnett for Radio Catskill.
Thank you so much, Genevieve, for that report. Well, that's it for the local edition tonight. I'm Jason Dole. I'll be back here with you again tomorrow. For now, you want to stay with us? We got the Retro Cocktail Hour coming up at 7. But before that, we've got more news on the way from The Daily. This is Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Chester's, a working art studio and gallery by the Brook in Berryville, offering a creative escape for individuals and groups. Events, info, gallery rental pop-ups, and classes at chesterscreative.com. And from The Overlook, a new nonprofit newsroom covering Woodstock, Saugerties, Hunter, Hurley, Olive, and Shandaken. News, culture, community, and more at theoverlooknews.com. And from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio